know, we welcome the competition with illegal production, but it's just the pirates that, you know, have a leg up.
Illegal fishing weighs down the price of Bering Sea red king crab. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, November 26th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Juneau considers removing controversial texts from the school district curriculum.
It's called historical appropriation when you take an historical event important in the Native community and reinvent it, if you will.
Tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Alaska Governor-elect Bill Walker has announced four new staff members, including an attorney general. Walker said in a news release that Craig Richards will serve as attorney general. Richards said he'll be reviewing the status of the National Guard investigation and the state's lawsuit that is trying to reinstate the ban on same-sex marriage. Walker also announced that he will retain Gary Folger as the public safety commissioner. Walker said a former University of Alaska Fairbanks vice chancellor, Pat Pitney, will be his budget director. She replaces Karen Ruffield, who retired last Friday after 35 years with the state. And Walker announced that Guy Bell will be retained as director of administrative services for the governor's office. The Bering Sea Red King Crab fleet finished catching 10 million pounds of quota last week, and they're facing some lackluster prices as the crab goes to market. It could be due to higher catch limits in Alaska and Russia. There's also the problem of pirates. Illegal crab harvesting is declining, but industry groups say it's still their biggest concern. KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports on what impact it had this year.
Crab economics can be a tricky business. Take it from Jake Jacobson, who heads up the state's biggest crab harvesting collective, the Intercooperative Exchange.
Supply is really the thing that drives the market, and the Japanese exchange rate is pretty close up there, too. And then, of course, quality of the crab and other issues all factor in.
Dockside prices for Alaskan red king crab were down as much as a dollar this season to around $6.10, according to the State Department of Fish and Game. There are plenty of reasons why that could be, like the higher quotas in Alaska and Russia, and currency values giving big Japanese importers a better deal in Russian rubles than in dollars. And Jacobson says Alaska's fleet had another problem this year, unexpected barnacles on some of their catch.
So those crab don't typically receive the same price as a clean shell crab, so there's a little bit of a discount there.
But it's all secondary to what he says is still the biggest problem for Alaska, illegal fishing and overharvesting by pirate boats in Russia. Years ago, Russian pirates caught and delivered more than four times as much king and snow crab as the country's legal harvest limit. Since then, that number's declined to its lowest point in a decade, says Heather Brandon of the World Wildlife Fund.
But even the last year that we have data for, which is 2013, there was still about 69% harvest over the legal catch. So we can see from trade data that there's still a huge amount of illegal crab entering the market from Russia.
Brandon co-authored a recent World Wildlife report on illegal crab fishing. It calls for countries that import and export crab to work on stamping out pirate fishing, like by asking for more documentation as the crab makes its way from dock to market. One agreement between Russia and Japan will do just that, starting in December. Japan takes most of Russia's exports due to proximity, but plenty of Alaska's catch winds up there, too. That leaves American consumers buying crab that's estimated to be 40% illegal. Jake Jacobson with the Harvester Co-op says it's tough to verify where the product comes from.
The boats that supposedly made the landings are fictitious. They're signed with names of captains that don't exist. All the documents look legal because they've been professionally forged.
That's why groups like his are pushing for stricter labeling and tracking requirements. And as always, they want customers to buy domestic. They say Alaska's fishery is better regulated, better documented, and more sustainable than any other. Of course, that makes it more expensive than illegal crab, too. Mark Gleason is the president of the Alaska Bering Sea Crabbers, which estimates Alaska has lost $600 million to pirate crabbing since 2000.
You know, the people that I represent, they're capitalists. They thrive on competition. We're very proud of the product that we produce, and we will put that product up against anyone's. But it's got to be a level playing field in terms of the competition. You know, we all need to be playing by the same rules. We all need to have the same opportunity to bring our product to market. And we, you know, we welcome the competition with the legal production, but it's just the pirates that, you know, have a leg up.
Still, Gleason thinks it's possible to stop illegal crab fishing. He points to signs of progress, more international cooperation, and regulatory support from lawmakers who groups like his have been lobbying. And there's last year's lower illegal harvest, too. But what about this year? It's kind of a wild card since there's also more legal crab on the market than in the past. Heather Brandon with the World Wildlife Fund says she isn't sure if higher legal quotas will make for less pirate fishing, and she won't get to find out for about a year.
I'm really looking forward to looking at the 2014 data to understand that. There are a lot of factors in play.
Meaning it's not clear if pirate fishing was to blame for this year's lower red king crab prices in Alaska. Still, fishermen say they have to control what they can. The fleet can't alter the laws of supply and demand, but they'll still lobby to rid that supply of crab that shouldn't be there. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Iditarod musher Karen Hendrickson was injured last night when a Talkeetna woman lost control of her vehicle and struck the ATV that Hendrickson's dog team was pulling. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
Alaska State Troopers received a call just before 7:30 on Tuesday evening that a vehicle had struck the ATV ridden by musher Karen Hendrickson near Mile 91 of the Parks Highway. Troopers say that Mabel Quilliam of Talkeetna was driving northbound on the highway when her vehicle left the road and collided with Hendrickson's ATV. Hendrickson was being pulled by her sled dog team on a training run at the time. Quilliam was not reported as being injured. Hendrickson was taken from the scene by Talkeetna EMS and eventually to Providence, Alaska Medical Center in Anchorage. Maliko Yubel is Hendrickson's handler. She says she spoke with Hendrickson on Wednesday about her injuries.
I talked to her this morning. She sounds pretty good, but it sounds like something in her back is broken. I don't know what that means. And she also has a broken leg.
Shortly after the incident, word spread quickly on social media. The dog team got loose as a result of the collision, but Maliko Yubel says the Willow Mushing community was quick to assist in rounding them up again.
The mushing community really rallied around us and came out and helped, and there were several people out with trucks and trailers, and the last dog finally showed up here on her own at 6 o'clock this morning, so, and she looks like she's in really good shape.
Maliko Yubel says that only two of the dogs show any signs of injury. The severity of Hendrickson's broken bones is not publicly known. She's listed in fair condition by Providence, Alaska Medical Center. Hendrickson has signed up for the 2015 Iditarod and has run the race 6 times in the past. It's not known yet whether her injuries will keep her from her 7th attempt next March. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the quest to design the perfect Alaska cabin.
What are those things that are challenging to me? Okay, well, it's cold and it's dark. How do we turn that around so that I'm suddenly saying, oh, I can't wait for that darkness to happen?
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
A Palmer resident has been sentenced to 50 years in federal prison on multiple charges of child sexual exploitation. 49-year-old Robert Earl Cunningham, also known as Bear Cunningham, and a registered sex offender, will serve the term concurrently with an 88-year state sentence. Cunningham was sentenced in Anchorage on Tuesday by U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason to the maximum terms allowed on 6 counts of child sexual exploitation. Assistant U.S. Attorney Audrey J. Renshin, who declined to go on tape, says the state had already sentenced Cunningham on multiple charges of sexual abuse of a minor. Cunningham's case is a tangled one. State troopers became aware of the abuse in January of 2013 when two victims came forward. In April of that year, Cunningham was indicted on 46 counts of sexual abuse of a minor. He fled the state but was picked up by Oregon authorities and extradited to Alaska. Cunningham was previously convicted in federal court on child pornography charges in 2001 and was on probation at the time of the more recent incidents of abuse. A group sponsored by the YK Delta's Regional Native Corporation, Chilistas Regional Committee, voted this week to hold a governance convention next year. Delegates want to pursue the creation of a regional tribal government or make changes to the regional nonprofit. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
What the committee is calling a governance convention is tentatively scheduled for March of 2015. A vote is expected there on what direction to pursue. The details are still elusive, but Chilista says a new tribal government would involve the creation of a new tribe as well. Willie Casile is the Chilista board chair.
The enrollment is already in place for the village tribes. So basically, it would encompass the membership of the tribes that are already in existence.
Efforts to establish a regional tribal government have come up several times in past decades and with pushback. AVCP supplied a list of 16 groups that have opposed an AVCP resolution promoting a regional tribal government or the latest Chilista-sponsored version. A resolution from the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation says a regional tribal government would usurp the power of the 58 individual tribes they serve. AVCP President Myra Nanning has several questions.
One of the things that we kind of question is, would they have the authority to speak on behalf of all the tribes within the region, including some of the villages? Some of the tribes have written resolutions opposing the regional tribal government because they want to keep their individuality as tribes, and they feel that the regional tribal government will not be able to address the local village issues.
Chilista's Casile disputes that notion.
The authority already lies within the villages as individual tribes, and this regional government would not take any powers away from the tribes that are existing in each of our communities.
A draft 12-page constitution lays out a regional tribal government complete with three branches of government, power for law enforcement, and fish and game management. The resolution looks at capturing income taxes from Native corporations and assessing taxes on regional lands and businesses. For inspiration, proponents point to examples like the Inupiaq community of the North Slope and the Tlingit Haida Central Council. The committee also looked at creating a borough government under state law, but that idea was rejected. A list of possible changes to AVCP include changing the name to the Association of Sovereign Yupik Villages, providing for direct election of the president, and changing the charter to allow the president to take executive action. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
The Juneau School District will decide next week if four controversial texts will remain part of the elementary school curriculum. Members and organizations of Juneau's Alaska Native community raised concerns about texts depicting Alaska Native and Native American experiences, like boarding schools and the Trail of Tears. A cultural specialist calls the text inaccurate and distorted, and a school district committee voted to remove the books from the classroom. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Fourth and fifth grade teacher Shagen George remembers unpacking books for the new language arts curriculum a week before school started.
Oh my, that's not very good. And came across another one and went, oh my gosh, this is getting worse. And by the time I got to the fourth book, I was just shaking.
One of the readers, called Continuing On, follows a Cherokee boy named John as he, his family, and thousands of other Cherokee are forced to leave their homeland, a tragedy known as the Trail of Tears. In the story, John's father says, quote, "The long, miserable journey and the hard times will make us stronger in the end." Another tells the story of a Native American girl in a boarding school. From the late 1800s into the mid-1900s, the federal government split families and forced Native children into boarding schools to assimilate. The text describes some of the hardships, but glosses over the loss of cultural identity. George says the readers are condescending and trivialize the true experiences of Native people.
In our community, we deal with the effects of these every day now, still, you know, with the boarding schools and trying to keep our language, and those are directly related.
After George first drew attention to the texts in August, the school district's Native Education Advisory Committee held public meetings filled with emotional testimony. The district also asked Paul Berg to assess the readings, which are part of McGraw-Hill's Reading Wonders program. Berg is a former teacher and now works as a curriculum developer and cultural specialist at Gold Belt Heritage Foundation. He says the author of Continuing On minimizes the emotional suffering of the boy who's able to let go of his pain.
The Trail of Tears was a death march. 25% of the people who went on this march perished. This boy, at the end of the march, is a highly traumatized individual. And the writer kind of ascribes to the school of pop psychology, where you just get over it. And you don't. It can take years to overcome it. It has very severe effects.
Berg reached out to the Cherokee Nation, and representatives sent written comment listing inaccuracies in the text and called it a poor choice for the classroom. Three of the four challenged readers are called historical fiction, but Berg says they lean toward rewriting history.
It's called historical appropriation when you take an historical event important in the Native community and reinvent it, if you will.
Berg adds the community shouldn't let national publishing companies like McGraw-Hill decide what children are reading.
They are not the authority in reading. We are the professionals. We are the educators. We are the parents. We're the grandparents. We need to be the one that makes the actual decision.
Berg's report recommends discarding the publications and replacing them with locally developed materials from the Alaska Native perspective. The readers aren't scheduled to be used until April. A district committee that reviewed the challenged material voted 7-2 to remove the four readers from the classroom. Ted Wilson, the district's director of teaching and learning, voted to keep the texts.
I recognize that the books don't do a great job of telling the story. I did not see them as being as damaging as what other perspectives see them as being.
Wilson says another committee has already met to find alternative literature.
Given the nature of these texts and the concerns that have been raised, it would be in the best interests of everybody to have identified and present in the classroom other texts to be used either in place of these or in concert with these texts.
The superintendent will make a final decision on the controversial readers in early December. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Winter is a time to focus on home and family, a time for eating good food and telling stories. This season, the Salmon Project is thankful to be sharing Alaskan salmon stories from around the state. The Salmon Project celebrates Alaskans' deep personal relationships with salmon as food, a source of pride, a way of life, and as the focus of a lot of fun. To read Alaskan stories or share your own, visit salmonproject.org/story. Salmon, it runs deep in all of us. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
A cross-country skier from Fairbanks is taking on the world's best. Alaska Pacific University team member Reese Honeman, who grew up in Fairbanks, will compete for the U.S. ski team in World Cup races in Europe over the next month. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Reese Honeman is just the latest member of the Alaska Pacific University ski squad to make the big time. World Cup sprint champion Keegan Randall and the brother-sister duo of Eric and Sadie Bjornsson also ski with APU when they're not representing the U.S. in Europe. The 24-year-old Honeman earned World Cup starts by finishing on top in domestic races last winter. Speaking via Skype from northern Finland, where the World Cup cross-country season kicks off this weekend, Honeman describes a high-profile European ski scene.
There's tens and tens and tens of thousands of people out watching. It's on primetime television, you know, all over Europe, tens of millions of people watching you.
Honeman has skied a few other World Cup races in recent years, but being on the tour full time is a new challenge, and he wants to make the most of it.
I'm planning to race everything just because I've kind of focused on getting myself to a point where I can be competitive and in every event, sprint, distance, like long, short, classic skate. So that's something I've been focusing on over the last couple of years.
Hahnemann's status as U.S. Super Tour champion guarantees him World Cup starts through December, starting this weekend in Finland and continuing subsequent weekends through Christmas in Norway, Switzerland, and France.
And depending on my results, I may get the chance to stay. I might get asked to come to other big events later in the year, more World Cups. One of my big goals is to make the World Championships team, which is going to be just a very select group, similar to the Olympic team.
Hahnemann's first races are a classic technique sprint on Saturday and a 15-kilometer classic race Sunday in Ruka, Finland. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
As the state is cloaked in darkness and cold, cabin fever starts to set in, but some Alaskans think they can fight winter's scourge by reinventing the spaces we inhabit. The Alaska Design Forum is hosting a challenge to get community members and designers to reconsider the cabin of the future. KSKA's Ann Hillman learned more.
Rochelle Dowdy is the project manager for the Cabin Fever Design Challenge, and she lives in a cabin that's a bit more of the past than the future. Part of it's made from a manufactured housing unit from the pipeline days.
The other part of my cabin is made out of broken down snow machine pallets that I reclaimed the 2x6s for. And it has hidden, like, framed in doors and windows for future add-ons. So it's that very Alaska style architecture.
Dowdy lives in Esther near Fairbanks. She doesn't have plumbing, electricity, or internet access. And when she thinks of a cabin in the future, it would have all of those practical amenities. Alaska Design Forum Director Holly McQuinn says the idea of the Cabin Design Challenge is to get artists, architects, cabin dwellers, and everyone else to think about a cabin that fits into the state's unique environment. It could even help solve some of the state's challenges, like the sadness brought on by winter.
I was thinking, well, what are those things that are challenging to me? Okay, well, it's cold and it's dark. Well, how do we play with those things? How do we turn that around? And how do we think, wow, I'm going to use this darkness and, like, maybe do a light show in my living room or use some kind of manipulation of light to that where my perspective shifts so that I'm suddenly saying, oh, I can't wait for that darkness to happen.
McQuinn dreams about cabins with robots doing housework as well. Up to 40 design teams from around the state can sign up for the contest. No design experience is necessary. McQuinn says it's a professional development exercise as well. Participants will display models and drawings of their entries at an art gallery and receive professional photos for their portfolios.
Possibly some of these could actually be built or developed future projects. You know, who knows? The sky's the limit.
Anchorage architect Roy Roundtree says that's why he's participating in the contest, to let his mind explore in ways normal work doesn't allow.
You never got a chance to really spread your wings as a designer, you know, to really think outside the box, because there was always a client there to pull you back and say, hey, wait, where's that deadline? Where's those drawings? You know, I wanted 5 bathrooms, not 4.
As he starts preparing for the contest, Roundtree says he's thinking about what a cabin really is. Why do people live in them? Do they want to be part of the wilderness, to harvest from the wild? Is a cabin social or solitary?
How does your mind change when you journey to a cabin?
So what will Roundtree's cabin of the future be? He says he's not sure, but he has until the contest closes on January 29th to decide. Participants need to sign up by December 8th. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
A lot of time and energy goes into what we eat for Thanksgiving, but what about what we drink? APRN's Dave Waldron talked to a local wine expert and has this story.
Ann Biker's day job is architect, but she also works weekends at Unwind, a wine boutique in Midtown Anchorage. She knows a lot about wine these days, but that wasn't always the case.
Probably like any other young girl, I started with the Boone's Farm and the awful, you know, things of that nature, and quickly worked myself up to have, I don't know if I call it a refined palate, but a more expensive one, certainly.
And that was a big factor in Biker learning more about wine. She says if she's going to spend more than $15 on a bottle of wine, she wants to like it. So she started asking questions.
What is it I'm tasting? You know, why do I love this? That made me think about it. Think about the way it smelled, the way it looked, the way it tasted, the way it hit my mouth when I drank it.
Biker says she loves Thanksgiving, and not just the eating part.
I just have a lot of fun with trying to pair the appropriate wines with the food that we have.
And that can be tricky with so many rich and heavy foods. That's why Biker starts her Thanksgiving with a bang, or in this case, a pop.
I'll typically start off with champagne. If I were to recommend something, though, I would say sparkling rosé. It's different. It's got that little bit of red juice to it. But I think what it does is it sets that celebratory mood. And when you're drinking a sparkling between multiple appetizers, it sort of acts as a palate cleanser.
Next up, and probably the most important, is what to drink with your turkey, ham, or roast.
I'm definitely going to lean towards a red on this one. And you always hear about Pinot Noir and Zinfandel. And those are great choices. But this particular Thanksgiving, I'm going to kind of throw a curveball and do Grenache. So a typical Grenache is going to be medium-bodied, really low in tannins, kind of spicy. You're going to get huckleberry and wild strawberry. It's such an easy drinking red, but it's not one that you typically see on the Thanksgiving table.
And lastly, we're going to need something to drink with that pumpkin pie.
This is a hard category for me because I'm not a big sweets person. I tend to lean towards tawny ports. It's a fortified wine. It's fortified with grape brandy. On the scale of sweetness, it kind of falls in the middle. The older they are, the more fig and nutty flavors like walnuts that you're going to get. It's an absolutely beautiful wine.
Okay, so as much fun as this is, I think most families, mine included, will not be pairing wine with individual foods. We're going to get as many different foods on the plate as we can. So what's the one wine you would pick to go with a traditional Thanksgiving plate?
The one wine. Well, in my personal opinion, and what I plan on bringing to the table this year is going to be Grenache. I think it's so dynamic and so interesting. There's so many characteristics from Grenache that I think most people would find incredibly pleasing and complimentary to, you know, most everything that makes up the bulk of a Thanksgiving dinner.
For the non-drinkers at your Thanksgiving, Biker says you can't go wrong with sparkling cider. She says there's also non-alcoholic wine out there that's pretty good.
They actually mimic the taste of wine quite well. It's pretty amazing. With that being said, it's not something that I would drink, unless, of course, I needed to.
And we can't forget about the leftovers. Biker says she likes her turkey and gravy sandwich the next day with a nice glass of Pinot Noir. For APRN, I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Lisa Fu in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Locke. Here.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
And by
Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. You've heard of Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, and Cyber Monday. Well, now you're hearing about Giving Tuesday, a day to kick off the season of giving back on Tuesday, December the 2nd. Celebrate the season of giving with Alaska Public Media and the Alaska Community Foundation on Tuesday, December the 2nd, by giving a gift to the cause you care about most. When you live and give in Alaska, you make a real difference in your home community.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.